Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome back to the HRO Adventures podcast. This is Dave, and I'm here with Rusty. Good morning, Rusty. How are you?
Good morning, Dave. I'm doing great. How about your day?
We're doing all right. The sun is out over in Western Washington after it snowed last night. So we've got snow and sun right now. So I don't think anybody knows what to do.
Well, I don't even think we froze last night here.
You didn't.
The sun's shining. We got a little bit of a breeze, but it's a beautiful day. Beautiful spring day here. At the normal HRO studio.
There you go. So yeah, we're on the split screen here while I'm over in Western Washington getting ready to go do some things with Fish Hunt Northwest and get some archery stuff in the mix. So appreciate you being flexible and doing a remote one. We needed to do a remote one anyway for testing purposes. So here it goes, right?
I know. But actually, I think we sound, I hate to say we sound better when we're remote, but I think we sound pretty good today.
Yeah. So for a couple of outdoors people that have no business touching computers or cameras or microphones, we're doing pretty good, aren't we?
Doing good.
So, well, I appreciate the flexibility. Thanks for letting me be in kind of two places at once and get a bunch of stuff done for the group. So appreciate it. Let's see. Today's topic is habitat. And as we kind of were jotting down some notes and talking, when you start thinking about it, boy, habitat just jumps out more and more and more as one of the sort of keystones to being able to do whatever outdoor pursuits somebody wants, right? So we're talking to our mule deer guys, our pheasant guys, the people coming out to look at the geological formations, the folks that are coming out to do bird watching and cameras. It all plays into understanding the critters that you're looking at, right?
Yeah.
So,
does. And I'll tell you, this spring, you know, everybody's got the cabin fever. Everybody's been in the inside, and you know, you've been doing all your winter sports and those kind of things. And
yeah, like,
you
know, eating.
Exactly. Like eating, you know, have I got rid of that Christmas ham yet that I ate and all those pies, you know, how many pecan pies did I have this week?
They could be in the championship of the pie and the ham eating. So yeah,
exactly. Can I still zip up my vest when I put it on in the morning?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it's the real test, isn't it? As if your stuff still fits.
It is some days. So, you know, but now even though it snowed on you guys this morning, you know, our snow's starting to leave over here. The pheasant guys are coming in, training their dogs for the last couple hunts here. And so it's been, everybody's starting to think about it now. You know, the grass is starting to grow. We're starting to see the weeds starting to pop up, and just all the little stuff is starting to come. And so the thinking of the habitat is a big deal right now. Because, you know, did the snow run off? Are the roads washed out? You know, all of those things, because that all makes a difference to the habitat for the animals out there as well. You know, are there ponds still good? You know, I've seen where some of those ponds that the old timers that homesteaded all this place, you know, put up some dams so that they could catch some water in the runoff. You know, if those dams aren't being taken care of, those dams will wash out, and then
they'll
lose their summer water that they would have in the late spring. You know. And so now's the time that, you know, we're out and about looking at all those things. Farmers, ranchers are all doing those things, but a sportsman should be doing the same thing. We should be thinking about it the same way. You know, was there a heavy snowpack? You know, how does the water look? These are all things, the way that Washington State does their permit process, you know, they don't even approve the booklet until at the April meeting. So all the seasons are being jockeyed and shook around right now. And looking at that, we should be preparing for that too, so that we're ready when that booklet comes out. We can start looking to see what permits are there, where we're going to be going. And then that plays right into the habitat. You know, where did they have good snow? Where do they have good water flow, good lakes, good, that kind of stuff. You know, are we going to have a good spring, you know, for the elk? You know, I mean, you know, right now, driving down the west side of Snoqualmie Pass, when you're getting towards the bottom there, you're going to see the elk on the side of the freeway, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, because that's the first stuff that greens up.
Yeah, right.
You know, they know exactly where to go. Mm-hmm. And so we do too. The reservoir at my house is full. Been several years since that reservoir has been full, and right now it's right at the top of the dam, almost ready to go around the overflow. And this morning, at daylight, the geese and the swans and the snow geese and the ducks, and there's like, I don't know, 8 different species of ducks out there on the pond right now. And that's just the huntable birds that we're talking about. Well, except for the swans, but the cranes are starting to come in. We're going to be seeing the sandhill cranes come in, and a lot of people come out and see. I don't know how many tour buses I've seen at my house. I'll get up there for lunch, and here'll be 60 people all standing outside of a bus with their spotting scopes and binoculars, looking at the reservoir when it's full like this. So. That's a fantastic deal for people to come out and see them.
The flyway patterns, if you're a duck guy, the flyways, the migration patterns, all that follow a habitat thing, don't they? They're not flying over areas they can't use, right? So,
yeah.
So it all, if you're going to be a hunter, outdoorsman, photographer, whatever, learning your species, learning what they look for cover. Everything does need cover. Everything needs food. Everything needs water. And figuring out how they use that stuff is the key to having success out there, right? So
yeah, absolutely. I remember we had a guy come in, and he was a photographer, a professional photographer. And so he would take a lot of footage for different documentaries, worked for different production crews. All of his stuff was for sale. I mean, you can see a lot of his pictures online that you can buy, to put on, purchase his picture to put on your front page or your magazine or whatever. Anyway, he came out. I got to know him really well there for several years. One of the years that the reservoir filled up, he was taking pictures of everything. I mean, he'd spend almost every daylight hour out there in his little blind that he set up. The birds had all gotten used to it.
Yeah.
And he sends me this picture, and he goes, and it was a beautiful picture, and it's a bird I didn't recognize, and it was an eared grebe.
Never heard of that.
Beautiful, beautiful bird. And I showed it to the fish and wildlife guy, and he goes, "Where was this picture taken?" I said, "It's at my house on the reservoir." And he goes, "Oh my goodness, we didn't know we had these birds here." And he got so excited. And first thing my brother says is, "Oh, great. One more species that are going to come out and tell us we're farming the wrong way and doing all those things." And, that's something that a lot of farmers deal with. We have dealt with over our time with the endangered species listings and all this. And I remember a guy on the sage grouse. That's a big, hot button issue for the National Fish and Wildlife is the sage grouse initiative. And he told me on the sage grouse, he goes, "Yeah," he says, "they're going to come out and they're going to attack you for hunt or for farming because, the numbers aren't great and it's all because of farming." He says, "Actually, your fence rows is where they're all, he says, "Do not take that fence down because that row is holding everything right now. That's where they're all nesting. And don't take that sagebrush over there. Make sure that sagebrush stays good." And it's kind of like, okay, well, if I, went out there and did, all of a sudden the birds have learned how to adapt into the grazing, into farming. And so, we know that they're here because of the farming as much as anything else. Mm-hmm. And so, but I'll tell you what, I've talked to landowners that are on both sides of that fight. So, but that habitat, now that's back to this habitat that we're talking about. And, when that reservoir is full, I made the mistake of showing the reservoir to the Ducks Unlimited guys. We were trying to work on what can we do to make this habitat better? And the guy comes out and he looks at it and it's full and there's 8 different species of ducks out there and talking about the flyway. And him and the other guy from DU, the conservation guy, came out and looked and go, "Oh, this is absolutely perfect. Don't change a thing. Make sure it's this way every year." And I go, "That's the deal, guys. It's only this way when we have a nice runoff and we have the snow to fill it. So what can we do to make sure it's this way every year?" And they're like going, "It's perfect. Don't change a thing." I'm going, Okay, well, it's perfect every 6-7 years, every 8 years, it's perfect.
Exactly right.
I would like to make it perfect, you know, half of those years at least, you know, if not every year.
So, yeah.
And in dry land where I'm at, we don't have irrigation. I don't have the water, the surface water to play with. I can't flood a field and then take the water.
Yeah.
I don't have those. That's not in my toolbox
here. Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, I get my 9 inches of rain a year, and it doesn't always come in the same day.
And you got to do what you got to do with it, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Like a miracle worker out there, really. Well, you mentioned a toolbox and tools. And so what I wanted to start off with is, you know, how does somebody become a habitat, you know, layperson or whatever, and at least know what they look at. So the biggest one I can think of is OnX. People might not even know it, but when they're looking at OnX and figuring out where to go, you're really looking at what habitat holds, you know, whatever it is you're looking for, mule deer, elk or whatever, right there. And so, you know, you're looking for draws or water sources or wallows, right? You're basically using aerial photography to come up with a tactic, but the habitat's going to dictate what you're doing. Are you doing long shots, short shots? Are you, you know, needing spotting scopes or binoculars work, right? Depending on what kind of cover, you know, all that stuff is habitat. So I think OnX is a great tool. What are some other tools you guys are using?
Well, OnX is, it's funny, you know, born and raised on the same piece of property. So, you know, I know where the water tanks are and where the water goes and where it is on good years and bad years and what, you know, and I've done a lot of spring developments. I've worked with Fish and Wildlife, putting in spring developments and doing those kind of things on our property. When OnX came out and they started tagging these springs, starting tagging where there's water, showing where those waterways are. We have several intermittent springs or waterways here in the where I live in my county. That, you know, it's a waterway, yes, but then all of a sudden you walk over there and it's dry, and it's like, well, yeah. Wait a minute, there was just water, you know, half a mile up the road here, and now that's dry. And then you go a quarter mile down the waterway, and here it is again. It's back out of the ground. Those now, OnX says, yes, there's water here. That's, you got to go get on the ground. Though, you know, I know the ground around here very, very well. When I look at it, where I go hunting, you know, not on my place, I know to go scout that. Go look at that to see where that water is pooling up, where that is working. But OnX is a great tool. And as far as I can see, all of those hunting apps like that, the Go Hunt app is another good one that goes, there's some scouting apps out there that are working with it. I even noticed, you know, in the Eastman Journal here not too long ago, they have an app now that helps you with your draws and everything. And of course, Eastman's of the, you know, they're well known for their DIY, you know, they're DIY guys. So you're doing your own scouting, you're doing your own thing. And I think that OnX has been, all of those apps have been a very big help to the DIY guy.
And they're really teaching you habitat, right? Yeah. What areas to cross off, because you know nothing will be there, and potential areas where something might be hanging out, whether it's because of the water, you know. And then you go into your animal knowledge, right? Of, you know, where are we at in the calendar? Are they doing water? Are they in a rut? Are they feeding? You know, are they moving? What are they doing? And, you know, you begin to line up the pieces.
Right.
But you guys use trail cams, I think, on some of your leases too, don't you?
So I think that's a great tool.
How's that changed the game?
Well, trail cams to me 10 years ago were cocaine. You know, I became very addicted to the thing. I spent hours and hours and hours going over pictures. My wife was sure I was doing something wrong on the computer because I was spending hours looking at my computer screen. You know, because my goodness, you can learn so much from a trail cam.
In hours, you can learn years worth of information, right?
Yes. Yeah. And you know, it used to take, you know, we used to say back when when I was running all over the country trying to learn elk areas, it seemed like it, by the time I hit my 30s, I was realizing, you know, it's taken me like 3 to 4 years to figure out each one of these elk areas, you know, and trying to keep up with one and learn a new one and then try to add another one in there, just more days out in the woods, which was fine. I loved it. But, boy, I'm telling you, with the tools that we have and the trail cameras that we have now, I can see so much more. I can figure things out a little bit better. You know, I show up and all of a sudden I have a trail camera that doesn't have any pictures on it. There's nothing. And yet, you know, 200 yards away, I just saw, you know, 25 elk walk through there. And I'm going, okay, well, I don't have a picture on mine. Well, that was because the idiot that put the camera up didn't put it in the right spot, pointed it the right direction. You know, learning where to do those things, that's back to your habitat again, because those, you got to learn where things like to move, where things like to travel, and they're going to follow from their bedding area to their eating areas are going to be the same. You've got to learn how to be able to read that habitat. You got to be able to learn where are they going to go for water, where are they going to go for food, and where are they going to go to lay down to get away from everybody, that they feel safe. That's the habitat for whatever animal you're looking at. And so the trail cameras are fantastic. The other thing great about trail cameras is now they've made them cellular, and the cellular ones, you can still buy the cellular ones up that $500-$600 range, but you can get cellular ones that do a pretty fair job for the same price as I was buying trail cams for, you know, 5-10 years ago. So they're making it more, and the plans aren't that bad. You know, I just a quick story about a trail camera is we put one up in the middle of the summer. I started seeing a trail foreman and seeing some tracks crossing the road. And so I kind of paid attention to that. I was trying to figure out where they were going. And so I walked the trail up on some private ground that I have leased, and I walked the trail up and started to see where they're starting to spread out a little bit. So I put two cameras up, kind of facing two different directions to make sure that I could see where they were coming and going. And there was a couple of pretty nice bucks, you know, that I was trying to pattern, trying to make sure I knew where they were for the summer. Yeah. The first thing I walked across my camera was an elk. So, you know, 2 days later, all of a sudden the camera's showing me this really nice bull elk walking by, and I'm going, okay, well, I like the horn size, but that's not the species I was looking for.
And that's a really big deer.
Exactly. That would be a world record deer at this point.
Exactly.
I was like, oh my gosh. Well, I was just blown away. And so of course that got my attention, and you know, and why do I have elk here? What's going on? You know, and that's not uncommon for us. I think the predators move the elk around as well. I live close enough to the Columbia. You know, if you're getting picked on in the trees in the mountains, all you got to do is swim across Columbia and you're in an open field where nobody's sneaking up on you, kind of thing. And so I think that's helped out. And I think that moves them around a little bit too. And that's my theory anyway. So the trail cameras are great, and I love the new cell ones. But you got to budget, or I have to budget, because I'll buy all the trail cameras and I'll put up trail cameras everywhere, and then I'll spend all my time running around changing chips and looking at pictures.
There's a little bit of maintenance,
right? There is, and it's nice That's the one thing about the cellular ones is I can share that with my guides. And so I'm not the only set of eyes. I trust them a lot of times to look at things and then tell me what they're seeing and going on. And that the team approach seems to work pretty nice.
Yeah. Yeah. So running the do-it-yourself stuff on the west side, you know, so much public land that I can go play on, but it's all out of range of cell. So it's a hike in, check your stuff, you know, weekly is what I was doing. And which I enjoyed, right? I mean, in the winter, I'm snowshoeing in, so you're getting your hikes in, your fitness in, all that kind of stuff. But the issue of, you know, not having cellular is a thing in certain areas. And where I'm at, I still have to go maintain those cameras. But what's neat is, I guess, a fishing people would call it the bycatch. But, you know, I'm out there looking for, say, turkey, but I find out elk are in this spot, or you're out for elk and you find bears, the one on your, so you do gather. So you just get an idea of what happens on this piece of land or area so much faster. I mean, it would take years to learn all that, right? And then you'll talk to maybe old timers or people that have been around. We don't have any bear here. It's like, well,
let me tell you,
you know what? I got pictures. And yeah. And a lot of times it's surprising. And just like you said, you know, with WDFW, right? I'll ask a couple questions of a biologist. They're like, you're finding bears over there, and or, you know, turkey or whatever. And they're like, we haven't had turkey over there in a long time. Like, well, I got a whole flock I'm watching over here. So, yeah, it's just you can gather information so quickly and pattern, and you know, it's just, and it makes it kind of fun too, because you can, like you said, you can share the pictures and you know, with the buddies, and kind of get everybody excited to go and whatnot.
Yeah.
Yeah, what kind of cameras do you like? I run Moultrie stuff,
yeah,
just because I've always had, and like I said, they're the non-cellular. They've got adapters. I can make them cellular. But part of my deal is that hike in to go check on my stuff too. So that's got an important part of it as well. What are you using?
I go clear back to when, you know, the camera actually had a flash on it. Big old bright flash, you know, but now with the infrared.
I've got a couple that have the flash, and I've had to had to get an extra chip to update them so the flash is infrared now. I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah.
You get pictures of animals with the big eyes, and obviously they were spooked by the thing going off, right? So I've got a couple old ones that clicked, and now, you know, now I've got the ones that are infrared. You'll never know it's there.
You know,
but, I did start with those that as you walk up to it, click, click, you're like, oh, that's probably why there's nothing on this thing.
Well, and, you know, Tacticam came out with the ones that, you know, they don't have the all the lights on them. And so they're a little bit more stealthy. Not everybody's going to see them. And I know a lot of guys, especially on public land, putting their trail cameras out, you know, all of a sudden the trail camera's not there when they come back, you know. And if anybody's listening to my deal and you're stealing people's trail cams, go listen someplace else. I have no patience for stealing trail cams. You know, they're not that expensive. They're easy to put out there and easy to take a look at. You know, and then, you know, we've all learned, you know, if you've been doing trail cams very long, we've all learned how to put one up, and then you put another one up to watch that one. You can't just get one or two, and then cellular's kind of slowed a lot of that down. But I like, I like Tacticam. I've used their stuff. And I bought their video camera for digiscoping and different things. They've got good stuff. You know, I've used Stealth. The Stealth cameras are, seem to be pretty good. I haven't got into these new ones that'll take 180 or 360 degrees. It'll pick up motion and the camera moves and all that. I really like video, but video eats your chips really quick.
Yeah, I've got a couple that are just, I got them switched over, dedicated to video, and those will go in a different spot for a different reason.
And, absolutely. And, you know, and you know, I've had big bucks that'll come into a water tank. I'll put, you know, something on a water tank, especially in late summer when the water is getting hard to find, and I know they're traveling to the tanks. There is no puddles to drink out of anymore. The springs are pretty much just in the ground. There might be a wet spot there, but not enough to drink. And so they'll move to a tank. You know, and I try to do bursts on my deal. So I'll get, you know, 5 or 6 pictures of the animal, but then it won't just sit there and take all day. I don't know how many bears I've got, 45 minutes of pictures, you know, even that are shutting off for 3 minutes after it goes, you know. You're still 45 minutes. The bear will sit there and roll around and sniff your camera and play with it.
Yeah, they always sniff it, don't they?
Always do. But it must just be because of the oil on my fingers. That's where I was at.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if you have a camera out and you have a bear on it, trust me, the bear knows what you smell like. So, you know, you're not sneaking up on him the next time. He knows.
And I've got 30 or 40 hours of a piece of wheat blowing in the wind, you know, triggering it. So I've learned a lot of hard lessons, and there is definitely a learning curve, but there's an art to it, right? There's an art to you know, oh, the sun went down and triggered it, you know, like maybe I should point this somewhere. But I do have a lot of, you know, and species wise too, right? Like when I'm doing turkeys, it's got to be a little lower to the ground, which adds a difficulty. And I can't tell you how many pictures of snoods and beaks I have of a turkey. Like somebody's in that box. What's going on? I mean, it's hilarious. And you know, being here editing pictures and laughing, my wife's wondering what in the world's going on. And it's like, there's a bear licking the camera or a turkey pecking at it.
I had a real. But
where are they when I'm out
beautiful
there?
Beautiful buck, and I hadn't seen him for about a month. And so I'd kind of, okay, well, he's moved on me. He's laying down somewhere new. He's going to a new water hole. And so I just started running a whole bunch of cameras around that area, trying to figure out where is this big boy at? And I had a camera set up and it was doing six pictures and they would be a second, 1 second apart. Okay. Mm-hmm. I got two out of six pictures had him. The first one didn't. Then he was on two and three, and then four, five, and six were empty. Okay, well, did he only drink for 2 seconds and he moved off that fast as he came in?
And I'm like, phantom.
How did that happen?
Buck there.
And so I'm going, maybe this is why I don't see him very often. He knows what's going on. But one of the funniest pictures, because I have horned owls sitting on the side of the tank. There's some great pictures in the middle of the night. You got especially a lot of doves. During dove season.
The nighttime infrared is a whole other story, isn't it?
And then I would get these really pictures at night, and they would be like a twisted spiral, and they would just be this little short right in the middle of the picture, off to the side, or going up or going down. Mm-hmm. And it took me, I don't want to embarrass myself here, but it took me a long time to figure out.
This is all about embarrassing ourselves.
It took me a long time to figure out what that was. And once I thought I knew what it was, then I confirmed it. It was a bat. These bats would fly through and they fly
like in a berserk pattern, don't they? There is no beauty to how they go
and
through
the
air.
How the camera was catching them was amazing. I was almost like, you don't get the first bat, you get the second one or something. I don't know.
How they
trigger that infrared and then they get it. And then the other thing is like you said, camera positioning. What are we taking pictures of? You know, now that we do the wild chucker hunts here at Hidden Ranch Outfitters, I moved a camera down so that I could watch, because it seemed like I always saw the chuckers at the water tanks. I can tell you, they were almost a pattern of what time of day and how often they came. And so I got pictures of chuckers coming to a water hole, coming to a water tank. And the chuckers are about as bad as bears. I don't think they smell the camera, but they have to come over and peck on it, and they have to come look at it.
And the birds are definitely curious, aren't they? The birds will get themselves into trouble being so curious.
So,
I've got a lot of pictures of the top of the turkey's heads and the elk's calf. So, you know. All week it's out there. You get home, you snowshoe in 15 miles, download it, and you got kneecaps. You know, it's like, okay. So, there's definitely an art to it. And, you know, luckily I'm going in where places that nobody else would waste their time or whatever. So security's not the biggest deal, but there's ways to set cameras up. Decoy cameras from a garage sale, super cheap, are helpful. Yeah. There are, environmental people that feel like, you know, breaking up your camera or something solves the problem. And it's like, you know, I've given a couple lectures, I guess you could call them, at a couple of these groups where, you know, once again, we'll just tout the outdoorsman, but, you know, paying for duck stamps and ammunition and whatnot, those taxes are going into putting in the culverts, fixing that road after the washout, putting in the pit toilet at the hiking place. Trying to just kind of put a plea out there that if, you know, environmentally, if you're damaging that equipment, you're damaging the equipment of the people that are making that trailhead, that pit toilet, the map display that they have up for all the hikers. You know, it's going to be your outdoorsman that's fitting the bill for all that stuff, not the person in their Prius who didn't buy gas anywhere, brought their own tofu grape nuts. And, you know, we're supporting the local coffee guys. And how many diners have we supported just by doing a podcast? Well, you know,
every one of those people,
we're all in this together.
I know some of them that are, you know, that are question all of it. You know, we talk civilly. And
we can completely have civil discussions.
But every one of them loves my trail cam pictures. And it's kind of like, guys, you can do this as well. It's not just hunters that are doing this. You know, I says, I know a lot of biologists that put in a lot of food plots, a lot of things for uplands, and they're trying to find out what's using them, what kind of stuff. I watched a guy from FSA, or not FSA, NRCS, the USDA office over here. He put up some trail cameras in the middle of a green wheat field. And I started laughing. I've been running trail cameras for, you know, a decade, and he puts up these four trail cameras, and one's pointing north, one's pointing east, one's pointing west, one's pointing south, and he puts them up. They're all like 100 yards from each other, right out in the middle of this field. Okay. And I'm going, so what are you hoping to learn in the middle of this field? And he goes, I'm trying to figure out, you know, the direction and the pattern that these animals are moving when they're using this field. Cause he says, there's so many of them that are using it. And I'm going, but you put your cameras on a post right on the middle of the field. I mean, really? I mean, I put them on rock piles and other places where they lay shade and, you know, trails. That guy had the most amazing pictures. He let me come in and see all of his pictures. And I mean, he had antelope and he had deer and he had the doves and the sage grouse.
Oh my
gosh. I was just like, that was ingenious. You know, I learned so much. You know, it's funny how about the time I think I got something figured out, somebody shows me a new way.
Yeah. And what I like on mine, I've got weather data, right? So I've got some winds and some temperatures. And so you notice, you know, at 36 degrees, the activity, but at 30 degrees, the activity paused. Yes. You know what I mean? You really can build a database of just how these animals operate and think, and patterns emerge. And you times that by so many years, and all of a sudden, this should be the week they come in, and I'll be dang if they didn't come in, you know, and stuff like that.
Well, the same
and,
with the moon phases.
You know, day activity, night activity, you know, that kind of stuff.
Because the moon phases, I remember when that was, well, we can pattern deer exactly by the moon phase or the elk or whatever. I totally get it. But it's not a 100% science, because I've
tried. It's a wag
exactly.
At best, right?
But there is.
Yeah, if you got no other data, you could try this, right?
But
yeah.
The moon phase does play a part in it, just like the tide and everything else. So,
well, we were always taught that the deer will go nocturnal, right? And they come out at night to feed or whatever. And then, you know, you're driving out to your hunting area, tree stand, blind, whatever, at, you know, just before sun up. And there's, you know, there's deer visible. And I'm convinced that these deer are night owls at this phase. And what you're catching is them returning home to go get some sleep, right? Like they've been out partying all night. It's not like they got up in the dark and went and ate. They've been completely active and moving, and they're going to go bed down now that the sun's coming up at that particular phase. So it's kind of like, okay, wait a minute, you know? So, but, you know, in the South there was, at one point there was, this is when I was a kid many years ago, there was a spotlight program, right? On certain times of the year, you could have your spotlight mounted on your roll bar next to your KC lights. And why was that effective? Why do they respond to that? Right. And so just cool, different, things that, you know, we don't necessarily do that here, but, you know, I'm up DIY snowshoeing, looking for animals that have probably never seen a person again. And so talk about trying to, you know, do this with your arms tied behind your back, then add a bow to it. And it's just like the fly fishing. It's, you know, was already difficult enough. Let's make this more difficult. So, but, you know, that's where the role of the outfitter and guide pops in too, as another toolbox, right? This person has had eyes on this location or the locations that they like to use for many years or whatever. And, you know, that's another tool. They're going to help you narrow down right. the search, right? So right. I think it's important to just bring, you know, the outfitter in there. What are you paying for? You know, you're paying for a great experience, but the experience involves seeing something as opposed to seeing nothing, absolutely. Right? So, and you know, I don't know about your guys, but I would imagine that they come up and hunt with you for a few years and they do learn things every right. time they come up, right? It's not a drive you out, shoot that one and there you go. It's they're learning how to stalk, they're learning how to be accurate, they're learning how to get prepared, they are learning, you know, some biology stuff on the animal. You know, just butchering an animal, right, has a proficiency to it if you don't do it very much, or taking care of a fish or something like that. And there's a little bit of biology involved in why they are the way they are, right, and how to process them. So all good stuff and all part of the repertoire, right? So the scouting, the habitat knowledge, the animal knowledge, you know, regulations knowledge, all that kind of stuff all plays into being better and seeing something out there. So how can the habitat stuff specifically make you a better, let's just call it a outdoorsman, so our hunters and our photographers, how does the spending right. a few, you know, over the course of a few years learning, you know, the kind of bird you're trying to take a picture of or the type of raptor you're tracking or a mule deer. How can knowing the habit really actually make you more successful?
I think that when you start realizing what habitat, the role that habitat plays in all of this, just because there's elk in the Clockham or there's elk in the Blue Mountains doesn't mean you can just go down to the Blue Mountains and see elk everywhere. You need figure out where these places are, where they travel, how they travel. But here's the big thing is you need to be able to read the habitat, because wildfires change the habitat.
Yeah, it is all the changing time. All the time.
Logging will change the habitat. Access mm-hmm. will change the habitat. You know, if there used to be a place mm-hmm. where it was public access and everybody drove the road, and now all of a sudden there's a gate on it, yep. and there's only, you know, 100 keys to that gate or 50 keys or whatever, 50 people can get in, that changed mm-hmm. that habitat. That'll change that use. So it's important to always make sure that you go out and look. You know, here, you know, I live in a very farming heavy area. All of my leases have mm-hmm. cows and farming on them. And that changes. There's a rotation in the grazing. There's a rotation in the crops. There's a rotation in all of that. A hunter will come here and we'll shoot a deer in this canyon or on this field or whatever. And guess where he wants to go next year? You know, he wants to go right back to that spot. Well,
yeah, it's human nature.
I do the
right?
same thing when I go out.
Mm-hmm. Never done that before. Hunted the same stump for 6 years before you realize, hey, these animals can move.
So, you know, you learn where those habitat changes are, and you start playing that habitat.
Yeah, why was it there? What's making it go that direction? Maybe I can find another pattern, right?
So. You know, we'll see deer go back into a fresh burn. But you won't see them, you know, maybe mm-hmm. next year there'll be a few hanging around, like what happened here. And then they'll take a couple of years off. They will not use that burned area as much. You might see some new ones move in, but the older ones that have been there, mm-hmm. they've moved somewhere else. They've said, you know.
And there's certain growths and stuff that come like at year three, and all of a sudden you see them again, right?
You know.
Mm-hmm. So knowing that, you can cross something off your map and not waste the shoe leather, or you can, or the gas, or it might be time to, the grub should be coming up now. It should be time to head that way. Right. So, and there's some great, great things out there on YouTube about how to use Onyx and find fires and, you know, 3 years in when you should start working that area. Right. So yeah, it's all very cool.
I say the same thing as those apps are starting to realize there's a value in collecting that data and putting it into their maps so people can see them. And the other thing is, I really like that part in the toolbox of using that. So I know how many years it's been since that. They'll tell you how often it's burned. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't remember all the fire data, but yeah, I can go, okay, it's only been 1 year. We'll move to something else we know a little bit better. And then by year three, usually time to go looking. And sure enough, the exact same time, a little forage stuff is popping up.
And it's important. It's also important to go on and see where people have been harvesting. If you can get a hold of that data and you can figure out, how many deer have been shot in this area or whatever, on the harvest reports, and start looking at some of that kind of stuff. It also starts telling
there's
you
a reason.
Okay. Well, this area burned. It's going to be different now. Yeah. But if it burned 10 years ago, that's still a good area for those animals. They're going to move back into there after a decade or two. And if it doesn't burn again, and if they reforested it, these replanting areas. So you need to be looking at that. For out here, habitat is a big deal as far as green wheat. We're getting into some of these other crops now, such as canola, sunflowers, and those kind of things that guys are rotating into their crops, trying to aerate soil, doing some things differently than just absolutely out there turning it. And so because they're doing those things, it's going to change the pattern of, okay, when the grass starts turning in July and it starts getting dry, where are we going to go? Well, have they planted anything yet? Where's the green wheat going to be coming up, and how's that going to be going? That's all habitat change. And so the deer have figured it out. If you get a big old smart doe out here that's 7-8 years old, she's figured out exactly, okay, well, this year this piece is green wheat. Well, next year that one over there will be green wheat.
Yeah, she's literally twiddling her hooves like, hey, you're planning to wheat, right?
She knows I'm going to change where I'm walking and what I'm doing. So knowing your habitat is a big deal.
It's really a fun aspect of all the outdoor stuff, just like knowing your animals' behavior patterns, right? The habitat's moving their behavior patterns. So,
And you start looking at your Google Maps, your satellite pictures. Yeah. How long ago was that picture taken?
Yeah, exactly right.
Was it this year or was it last year's crop, or is this only 3 months old or 6 months old?
Yeah, the cameras and the Onyx and the sat maps and everything are all super, super helpful in planning, but there is no substitute for a boots on the ground scouting program, right? You will learn so much about what's going on and finding feathers and bones and hoof tracks and you know what I mean? It's just stuff you won't see. So it's an all-encompassing process, and that's what's fun about it, is there's so many levels. I always joke, like a fly tying stuff. I think that's for the off-season when there's nothing to fish. It's to give you something to do and keep you going to the fly shop to buy something, right? And scouting can be that way. We can scout and shed hunt. We can scout and go fish. I can go hunt turkeys in the spring, but I'm scouting for later on, right? I mean, you're always, always, always scouting is kind of where I'm at. And I don't know. It's a lot of fun. And a lot of times the scouting is even more fun. Getting somebody who knew nothing about it to the point where they're sending you pictures of stuff they found, because in my case, I've done some training and taught them how to do scouting and read tracks and all that kind of stuff. So I don't know. It's a lot of fun, and it's fun to share it with other people. So I wanted to cover some of the big groups. We can call them conservation groups, but Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, the National Wild Turkey Federation, Pheasants Forever, Ducks Unlimited, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If you go to their websites, it says something, something, and habitat, right? Conservation, so that, we can continue the tradition, but habitat, every one of them has to spend money on habitat. And at the end of the day, when they're a conservation group, they're really a habitat group, making sure there's habitat for whatever species is near and dear to their heart. So I jotted down some numbers, just if somebody doesn't think habitat is important. Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation spent $4.3 million across the board of, this was elk, mule deer, moose, sheep, and bear, but habitat, just putting fences, taking fences down, putting fences up, putting in drainage, taking out drainage, taking out certain weeds, putting in other types of grasses. And so in order to further their causes, whether you, you know, whether you agree with them or not, or like those kind of groups or not, spending that kind of money on habitat, you know, it'll tell you where you should be, and you know, how important that is. There was a I was listening to a business podcast recently, and the guy said, you don't need to spend money on research groups and all that. Just look where Starbucks is. Starbucks has put millions of dollars into picking that location. That's a good location for you to set up your business. It doesn't matter what your business is. They've done all the research on traffic and how many cars a minute. And I thought, you know, this is kind of similar, that if you thought, habitat's boring, it's not for me, you will find more success if you pay attention, because these big groups are spending more money than anything on habitat restoration or habitat protection in order to have whatever the desired animal is. They like, you know, come in and participate in their programs. So,
wasn't
anyway,
it the old story was McDonald's would spend millions and millions and millions of dollars on traffic counts and location and where people do this and that and where they eat and on and on and on. And Burger King just decided, well, we're just going to build one next to a McDonald's.
Right next door. Yeah.
You do the study, we'll just come in and follow you. And
yeah. And another one that I've employed, or what got me thinking about scouting, was there's a famous architect, and, you know, I don't remember the name, but he'd be, I think his specialty was designing universities and things like that. And so he'd build them, but never put in sidewalks, and just leave it grass. And then kind of in his contract, he'd come back in like 3 years and let's see where the paths are worn. Those are your best ergonomic, your best visual, and the most efficient places to put the sidewalk. So, you know, you wrap the sidewalk along the building and down to the parking lot and find out nobody's walking on it. They're walking across the main yard, right? And if you take that idea, and as I'm driving out to like your property, you start seeing game trails, right? Yeah. It starts to look like this is path of least resistance, probably very common. They're going to use it again. This is where I should set up, you know, in my case, you know, call it an ambush, set up an ambush or set up your cameras or whatever. You begin to see the world differently when you look at not where the world's forcing you to go, but where like animals go, right? You know, why do cougars like to walk the power line trails? Because it's easier than walking through the woods, right? Things like that, you know. And so it'll give you a new perspective, and it really opens up your peripheral on how animals are using the landscape. And then, you know, you exploit that, right, and figure out where your good places to set up are. So it's a really fun part of it. There's a lot of intricacy. And I think if you spend time on it, boy, your success rates of seeing goes way up, you know?
Absolutely. So, I think all those groups do a really good job in conservation. And they also, you know, I think they've done a very, very good job of in their publications, in their magazines, of showing it doesn't take, you go get a couple of copies of Bugle or a couple of copies of the MDF magazine, and you're going to see some great conservation projects, some waterhole projects, some guzzler projects, some taking fish.
It used to be kind of siloed, and this group really doesn't want anybody else. And I noticed with fishing and everything, it's, hey, you know, a broadcast on social media, we're doing net pens or doing this or that. If somebody can help take fence down or put in conduit, just meet here, bring grubby clothes, you know. So it's, again, it's outdoors people that seem to make that stuff work. And but also, too, locally with Fish and Game here at WDFW in Washington, they've got a habitat program that essentially has three prongs, right? So it's got the enforcement side. So, you know, everybody gets excited with the game warden showing up and all that. But remember, he's making sure we're not throwing our fishing line everywhere. He's making sure there's no damage that needs to be reported. He's making sure people aren't overfishing or hunting, you know. I always took at it as a, you know, it's a spot check, and it's, you know, he's out there, make sure the resource is there for everybody. There, you know, if you're not doing anything stupid, you shouldn't have any issue with it, right? And then they have the restoration side. So you can go to the, we just looked before we went on the air here, so to speak, the WDFW, type in WDFW habitat programs, and you'll come up with a list of initiatives and things going on that you can dive in on. And then the last one is the sort of the, what would you call it, constant evaluation, which I don't think people understand or ever thought of. I never really thought of it, but when we talk about CWD or overstressing the fish in the winter when the water, or in summer when the water's low and the temperatures are hot, there's this constant evaluation of programs. Do they work? Do they not? Or is this one working? Do we need to put more emphasis, right? The zebra mussels, the boating state check stations to make sure something invasive from one area isn't ending up in the other area and going to either wipe out the fish or cost money to fix it. You start thinking of budgeting and where your money goes, you could almost be kind of happy that your money's going to that and be okay writing those checks when you get your licenses and stuff, because there's these things cost money and they're never ending, right? They're especially that constant evaluation. There are biologists and folks that we know that are out there constantly making sure things are good and, you know, sending back data if we need to back off on hunting or fishing, or if it's, we're good to go to up a limit too, right? It goes both ways. So anyway.
Right. I've had really good luck, and I saw that, and I think you and me talked about that off air a little bit, that there was a recently Fish and Wildlife, if you have a wild ID number, they have your email. So you're getting emails from them when razor clam digging's good and whatever else seasons are coming on.
Yeah, yeah.
Make sure you get your multi-season tags bought and all those kind of things. But one came across that, hey, there are some volunteer programs. So, kids nowadays need so many, hours to graduate from high school.
Yep. Honor roll needs you to do stuff, and every activity seems to do it.
We're always looking for that. Yep. So, and there's programs that you can go right on WDFW site and see those habitat programs, those conservation programs. If you want to learn how to put in a food plot, or you want to learn how to put in a really nice habitat area that you can put in for the upland animals or the animals in your area, I keep talking upland because that's where I live, but it doesn't really matter where you live. There is some habitat things that you can do for whatever wildlife you have on your place. But go volunteer for some of these programs and you will learn these habitat specialists.
And you'll meet some extremely interesting people, right? Biologists and scientists and people that, just been kind of doing their thing and don't really get any spotlight. It's amazing to talk to the fish checker, or the person that's doing their grad studies, and they're telling you why, your king has markings of a silver on it and things like that. You're like, oh, there's hybrids out here. What's going on? So yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah. Well, and we see some crazy things. I've done a lot of equip grants, and where you got to go in and you got to apply for them. You need Fish and Wildlife to check off on that. The best thing that you could ever do if you're writing an equip grant is to go sit down with your habitat specialist, your biologist for your area, whatever, and sit down with them and put things in and have them help you write that, because they're always looking for grant money and they will actually help you put in those programs. And so you go out there and you do those things, and then they have to go back to the scientific overview committee and everybody has to look at them. And we were, we have one program that's taking fences out, because we don't want any fences and we can't do all this. And then we have another program that says, well, you need to cross fence this pasture because they're eating too close to the lake all the time. And we need them over here. We need to put water here so they don't, because they're just hammering it around the lake. Well, yeah, that's going to be the greenest grass. They're not going to walk further into the pasture. Well, so we had to cross fence. Well, now I'm putting fences in. So we have the SGI saying, don't take all the fences out. And then we have an equip grant that says you need to cross fence this pasture. So yeah, that's when you need those guys to help you do that. Funny story on that one was I show up and I see that they've added to my equip grant. The science community says, okay, we're going to approve all of these fences, even though we're against them. And I went, Well, first of all, why would you even say that in the program? Then they said that, and then they said, but we're going to mark the fences so that the sage grouse can see them. And I thought to myself, okay, we have sage grouse that live on the ground, that wander everywhere, wander around. Yes, they can fly, but they're not an eagle. They don't fly more than they walk. They walk more than they fly. And we're going to mark a fence so that they can see it, that they've walked around and nested under. And it would just seem funny to me as an outsider.
I think I saw that on Bugs Bunny. Didn't Wile E. Coyote make signs where the Roadrunner was supposed to be or something? That's probably why we see that weird, is we're like, hey, I saw this before, and it didn't work for the coyote either. So, yeah.
So they came out and they put these little, I call them flags, and I think they call them flags, but they're just hung on the fence, and so that you could see the fence. And so, they put them on a smooth wire fence because we thought that would be, when we wrote the equip grant, we put a smooth wire and made it hot, thinking less wires, smooth wire is not going to catch, doesn't have a barb on it, that kind of deal. We tried to outthink the science people. So then they go put, now all of a sudden it's harder to see a smooth wire because it's not doubled up, doesn't twist it or anything. And then they put a flag on it, and then the wind blows 0.5 mile an hour, and all the flags went down to the next post. And so there was this, 7 flags down there. It just was funny to see these kind of things. And then the one that really caught me the most was they said they wanted the habitat specialist for the area. He was to go walk the fence once a year and count how many carcasses there are of sage grouse that have ran into the fence and have died.
Oh, my gosh.
And I thought to myself, well, he's only going to know about the ones that ran into the fence and died in the last 2 days. Because there's enough predators out here. When there's a dead animal, it's going to be eaten and packed off. And so you're but apparently I wasn't part of the scientific crew.
Don't confuse me with the facts. And again, everybody's got their little agenda and their piece of the pie. But as the people that are either using or operating the space, you're like, those carcasses won't be there that many months out. So that's kind of different.
But I don't want to give it that, that was just a funny story, and they those programs do more good than harm. And so what we're trying to say is anybody that's trying to build habitat, that's trying to work on it, Fish and Wildlife has a program, like you were just bringing up, that they can get in, build their hours. They can do those kind of things. And it's not just a go help and get nothing out of it. It's actually go help, learn why we're doing that, how it's helping and why it's working for. And it'll make you, this goes back up to a question you asked earlier. Why is this important to us? Well, to understand the habitat is to make sure that we're conserving and moving forward, keeping a place to go elk hunting, deer hunting, and keep the animals good. So everybody's working on the same page here. We're really not against one another. We're just looking at it. We're looking at a quarter from both sides. Yeah.
Just have different parts of it. Yeah. Yeah. So as a former Cub Scout master leader and Boy Scout, go to the WDFW website or call local biologist. And it's a great way to get, they could use manpower, right? Planting or digging something up. It's usually a manpower issue that they're running. And you can get some kids involved. It'll count for their honor roll stuff or some of their sports teams for captains and leadership require some hours. But it's a little bit of a farm to table setup as well. You might have kids from out here learn about what goes on over by Grand Coulee Dam or something like that. And, these kiddos can grow up knowing that, stuff just doesn't arrive at Safeway. There's some things involved, and hey, don't do that because that'll affect the grasses over here, and just gives them a working knowledge of land, which is at the end of the day kind of you know, Scouts is looking at being, you know, good with people's money. Doesn't matter what the budget is, but being thrifty, it's looking at helping out and volunteering. And then, you know, you get to the outdoors have always been a great laboratory for leadership. So, you know, some people get to break into groups and lead. So it checks a lot of boxes. And there's even management merit badges now too. So Scout Masters or Cub Masters, just call your local WDFW, or even, you know, if you're in a different state, reach out to your fish and game folks, usually at their admin office, and then they can get you plugged in. But, you know, City Kids out in the fields is pretty unique. And you know, where else can you get something like that? You guys do like ag in the classroom out where you live, right? But out here we have some FFA, but it's few and far between. But it'd be neat for kids to see some animals, see some tracks, see some habitat and why it needs to be improved or changed, well, or you know, whatever. So anyway, great way to involve some kids.
And to build right on that, Dave, I totally agree with you that but if you're, you know, if to throw a little politics in here, you know, if you're voting, you know, if you're voting for, you know, anything climate related, or you're voting for anything conservation wise and everything, there's no better way to learn what you, why do you believe what you believe and why do you vote that way? You need to go out, spend some time putting some trees in, some shrubs in, taking fences down, putting fences up, getting that time outside with those biologists. The things that you will learn just in conversation, hammering a few staples in on a post, or planting a few shrubs down through a row and putting in some plastic, you know, those kind of things, you will learn a plethora of things that will help you be smarter when you're talking about who you're putting out there to represent us, to put pass these laws and do these things.
Yeah, and you'll make a better informed decision on your own. No, there's no influence in these. These aren't political positions, right? Biologists gathers the data, you know, fish, game, animals, stuff growing, and then reports to like a governor's task force or something. Then they take it, they decide what they're going to do, right? And so what we've seen in the past is the experts on the animals or the timber or whatever report, this is what you should do, and the governor's office decides to maybe go a different way. But the biologist they have the data. They're completely an apolitical section with everybody's best interest in mind, right? So you're not a fisherman or anything. Why in the world do we need hatchery programs or whatever? Well, there are some reasons why they're important, even if you're not a fisherman, right? Obviously, if I fish, so I like those things and will support fishing things. But there's reasons to make sure that's there for other kids or other people. There's some tribal interests, like, you know, if this all stuff goes away, it affects a lot of people. So, you know, it's not like the stadium where, hey, I don't go to a Seahawk game, so why should I support the stadium, right? That's a little more cut and dry. But non-fishing people, there's value in making sure the water is healthy enough for fish, and it's important to have the fish in there for certain reasons. And so, if you go spend the day with some of these folks, you'll find it's a zero politics. It's literally operating on the facts. If this happens, then this happens. And then all of a sudden, you know, if we put a dam here, this is going to destroy this. We should really think about if that's necessary. And, you know, what's interesting with conservation and habitat is it's a balance scale, isn't it? You move one piece, something else goes out of whack. So, you know, why do you need predator hunting? And there's people that are against that. I mean, especially with the trail cams, right? You see turkeys Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, and then Thursday a cougar's on your thing. There will not be any turkeys there the rest of that month, right? They are gone. And so, you know, again, not getting into anybody's ethics or morals on shooting coyotes or anything, but to have an elk population, you got to manage the predators or, you know, a deer population. And if the deer population gets too big, bad things happen. If it gets too small, things happen. So, you know, there's a balanced scale. And as long as everybody thinks about that, and then there's tools in the toolbox to manage that scale. But if we had no predators and just deer running rampant, disease and other things becomes an issue. And so, you know, if nature or habitat's been affected and you can't manage that, you can come up with a predator program to help manage that stuff, right? And nobody is out there trying to shoot hundreds of anything, at least in this state. Just trying to take a small part of it, help cull the herd a little bit if that's what's going on. And remember, the Master Hunter program used to have that, you know, try pick some sort of animal that's creating a disturbance too many times in a row and get rid of it kind of thing. But we're not out there just blasting everything. So it's a very balanced, a very tight scale. And boy, wildfire comes in and can throw that scale off. And so there's mitigation to try to make it not make such a big impact, right? So, and you see it in forestry and timber and, you know, everywhere. So if people just kind of can have an open mind, even if something doesn't apply to them, like you said, you may change who you're voting for public lands or something based on their understanding of how this works, right? So, and, you know, same with fish and game. When those guys are appointed, right, you can read the bios and kind of tell if somebody came from industry or came from farming or something like that, and you'll be able to figure out, you know, what their knowledge level is of how they see it. So, and, you know, as long as everybody's cordial and perfectly fine to ask questions and doesn't get all heated, but is willing to listen to somebody's thing, it's really interesting to learn about how the other side does stuff too, right? So, in my stuff, I found, you know, the hippie anti-hunting people actually have the same agenda as the people that are hunting, right? They want places to recreate and animals to see and stuff to forage. And it'd be kind of neat if we're all pulling on the same end of the rope rather than all the different silos, right? I mean, it's kind of like, you know, some of the religions, right? When you hear people arguing, you're like, are we talking about the same thing? I think we have different names, but it seems like we all have the same kind of idea. Yeah. Like, what are we fighting over? So anyway, just the outdoors presents so many unique things for kids to learn something and adults to learn something. And, you know, that's why we were involved in scouting so much. It's not my love of sleeping in the snow on the ground and stuff like that, which, you know, we figured out. It's the outdoors presents so many problems just naturally. And then you add man to it, right? So we've gotten a really neat group of biologists and other people that are, you know, unsung heroes. They're never on TV. You never hear from them, that make this place such a beautiful place to recreate in. So anyway, it's just kind of neat to think about. Well, with your ranching and farming and then your leases for like mule deer and stuff, what kind of programs are you running? Anything interesting, unique?
I don't have a program absolutely running at the moment. The last equip program we did was we put in some water, stretch some of the water out, kind of spread it out a little bit. And that really, in a very dry, arid area that I'm in, you know, our rainfall in my leases go from 9 inches to 12 inches a year. So it's,
I get that in like an hour.
yeah. And,
my yard is like a sponge out there.
Well, you got to remember, yeah. Dave, I live in an area where a 3-inch rain means that's how far it is between raindrops.
Yeah, exactly. So, right.
But yeah, we stretched out some water, we put some water pipes in, some water lines in, a couple of my lease, landowners, participated in the SGI program and put in one of them put in like 25 miles of water pipe. And, I don't know. I think he must've put in at least 10 tanks. I'm telling you what, that it made an immediate difference,
like right away. Right away.
Hmm. I mean, we saw within, as soon as the tanks were full, we saw a difference. The animals figured it out. The animals were, already using it inside that same season. So it was an immediate deal. So water is a big, huge issue. And and he knew that. He knew the importance of all of that, and put all of that in place when he got the program going. So
gotcha.
That was pretty cool. I have been doing my normal experimenting on trying to figure out. I watched too many Whitetail Institute videos.
Oh gosh,
and
I love that place.
Everything's east of the Mississippi in an area that gets 50 inches of rain a year. But it looks cool. And so I'd like to put in a 5-acre food plot, you know?
Wouldn't that be fun? Yeah.
So I found out that my 5-acre food plot is better if I do 15 acres. And then I take advantage of, you know, my brothers that are farmers and the equipment that we have. When the sprayer is spraying the field next door for weeds, you know, I can usually get, you know, a couple hundred gallons sprayed over on my area to take care of the weeds there. Even mm-hmm. though in most food plots, especially in this area, weeds are not a bad thing as long as they're not a noxious weed. And so some of the stuff we grow is considered a weed some places, but not here, you know? And so I've started to learn what works and how to put some of those food plots in. That's where I can tell you from experience that fish and wildlife programs really work, because I pick the habitat guy's brain all the time. And I've got two great ones here, you know, the one from Lincoln County, or one of the ones in Lincoln County, and the one here in Douglas County. Both of those guys are very super knowledgeable. You know, Todd knows, and I see Todd's posting on from Lincoln County. He's posting when he's got the tractor out and doing different things. Mm-hmm.
It is amazing.
Yeah.
It is amazing what those guys know.
And then Eric here in Douglas County, I mean, that guy's putting pictures of, you know, he sends pictures from his office, and he'll have a snowy mm-hmm. owl on a power pole, or mm-hmm. some hawk or an eagle on a fence post or something. And so it's great stuff. So
they're amazing what they know. And I think what's even more amazing is their willingness to share with everybody, right? They're not trying to keep it close to the vest. They want you to have an excellent time out there.
You know, we should have Todd and Eric come on and talk. Problem is, maybe you should. And me probably wouldn't get to talk if we had Todd and Eric here. So I don't know.
Oh gosh.
Those guys have a lot of stories and a lot of stuff. They've been doing it for a long time, but you know, if you could get on, and they're always looking for volunteers too, get on with those guys mm-hmm. and do some programs. And there's habitat guys in every area. So, you know, just find out, get to know them and work with your biologists, and you can get on that kind of stuff. Habitat is a big issue, and we all know it. And so we all use it. It's a great.
Yeah. Call your fish and game, you know, regional, you know, this is with whatever state, right? They usually are broken into regions or something, and call their admin thing, and somebody will put you through to them. And I think you'll find they're willing to take your call. They're never too busy. Tell them what you're trying to do, and they are happy to share, right? So, just neat stuff. And I'm always watching budget cuts and stuff just to make sure that, you know, guys like that are not getting affected, because those programs, they do so much stuff outside the confines of their job and their time, right? You know what I mean? It's
and they're always like, gosh, they're at every fundraiser. They're at every,
I was going to say, fundraiser and every local show. And I'm sure they're not getting overtime or anything.
We know everybody in town.
They know everybody in town, every landowner, let's see here. Real quick, could we kind of we're getting close on the end of the time here. Could we discuss, if you are, say, glassing, let's just use mule deer since that's your primary thing. What kind of habitat are you looking for mule deer-wise, good or bad? Just to kind of tie it together with how an actual scouting guy out there can tie habitat. What do you, when you get started and you got the spotting scope, you're sitting up on maybe a higher elevation, what kind of habitat are you looking for that's positive or negative for their movements?
I'm always looking for corridors, especially with mule deer. You're going to see those corridors that they're going to move into. You know, a mule deer, it might seem like he's standing on top of a hill when you're standing down in the bottom and he's skylined, and you're all, well, why is he standing up there on top of the hill? Rusty said he never stands on top of the hill. Well, they do have to go over the hill once in a while, but most generally it's the angle you're looking. You know, the mule deer realize when they're out in the open and when people can see them.
Yeah.
They do. They figure out. And, you know, mm-hmm. so, you know, I'm always looking for corridor areas, moving through the sagebrush, moving, you know, certain part of the hill where the walk is.
And how the wind affects that location, right? I mean, they're pretty playing much, the wind as much as anything
gonna,
else.
They're
right?
going to play the yeah. topography. They're going to play the topography game. Mm-hmm. And they're going to play the habitat. Mm-hmm. So if the grass is taller, the sagebrush is taller, they're going to move in yeah. and out of those things. You know, if you see a deer standing out in the middle of the field, well, he's been out there feeding for a while. I look at edges. The ones in the middle of the field stand out. You can see them. You don't need to glass the middle of the field. You need to glass the edges. And then when you're glassing those edges, you need to find the draws. You need to find the ridges. You need to find, you know, and where's he going to, where's he coming from? And so, cause he's going to be pointed that direction. Windy area. Yep. And so they're going to lay out of the wind. Mule deer have these great big ears that look like antennas, and the wind drives them crazy. Let's just take a seashell, for example, and just let the wind blow through it. You know, it's going to make a noise. Their ears are doing the same thing. It drives them crazy. That wind will make them hear craziness, and you'll see their ears moving a lot more during the windy days. It's a movement that catches you because, if you drive up on a high spot or a spot and you happen to be where they can see you, well, hopefully they can see you because you can see them. They'll freeze and stop and be a statue for 20 minutes. I had a archery guy or hunter behind me one time, and he goes, are we going to stand here as long as she stands here? I says, well, I could move and scare her to death, and then she's going to run all over and tell everybody that there's somebody crazy over there. I says, or we can just stand here, and then she'll figure out that, okay, well, they walked up there pretty calm and they're just standing there pretty calm. But I don't like them, but just walk away. I'm just going to walk over the hill or around the hill or around the way and get away from us. And I says, so it's just a patience game. And I says, we're bow hunters. Why? We don't run and gun with bows. So, and it was like, and he was just like, I've never seen anybody just, well, you know, I live in a very open area. That's the way we have to hunt. So,
I was going to say your topography, or if you're an antelope guy or something, you cannot make a lot of movements, right?
When I'm glassing and doing that kind of stuff, you know, I'm watching the edges, I'm watching the draws, I'm looking for, you know, I'll tell you one thing. If you're in an area that has cattle, if you're up in a grazing lease up in the mountains and there's cattle up there, there is no animal lazier than a cow. So when the cow walks from the good grass in this little meadow to the water tank or to the spring, they walk the easiest path known to mankind. So if you get on a cattle trail, it may wind around, and no cow can walk a straight line either. If you've never been on a trail, they wander all over. Yeah. Okay. But if you get on a cattle trail, you will find the best path from where they're going to where they're going to. Because those are the easiest pathways to cross. So if you see a cattle trail, you know, you may go, well, Rusty said those are always easy, but that cow trail goes, you know, up that hill. Well, there's only one way to get up the hill is you do have to walk up the hill, but the cow trail will always take you the same way. Game trails will take you through the brush.
That's definitely a pattern I've noticed, they have cover built into that. Yeah.
Because they like the cover.
They don't like standing out in the open. Yeah, that's for sure.
You might see deer tracks on a cow trail for a while, but as soon as that cow trail breaks out into an open area, that cow, that deer is going to move off that trail and look.
And that's how you can tell if you're tracking a cow or a deer, if you have hoof options.
Yeah, so
right?
If I'm glassing, I know that. Mm-hmm. I might see where a cow trail goes through there, and I know that's the best way, and the deer are going to use that as well. But they need the cover. They're going to move off in the brush and go around, or they'll walk in the rocks.
Yeah.
So they won't make it easy on you. So
no.
When you're glassing, you have to think of all of those things as well. You know, where. If I was walking that hillside, or if I was walking down through that draw, where would I, if I was walking there, where would I be looking for deer tracks? Yeah. That's where I need to be glassing.
Exactly. Exactly.
So that's kind of a little tip of the day.
Perfect.
If you're out there glassing and looking around, I mean, you and I, after the last podcast, we stepped out of the studio and we were standing there and I was showing you one of the long range shooting targets that I got set up, and all of a sudden an antelope walked out right in front of the target. So yeah, pretty cool.
Yeah, very cool. Well, Rusty, let's hit your calendar. What's your calendar look like before we sign off? We're in the middle of March, I guess, 2025, right?
Middle of March, I'm telling you. Spring is just like my brother's wanting to go farming all of a sudden. The snow is gone. The fields, we can see the fields now, and you can start seeing a little bit, like I said, a little bit of the grass growing, the weeds are just starting. So they're anxious to go farming, and I'm anxious to go, you know, start scouting, go out and do some shed hunting and starting those kind of things. I'm very, very anxious to get out there and start wandering around again and burning off that Christmas ham that I enjoy for a while. Maybe too much. And just get out and get some exercise, get outside, get some fresh air. The birds, like I said earlier, the hunters are coming with their dogs for them that last little bit just before it starts getting too warm. We've still got birds for those guys. So this last weekend was absolutely packed.
Wow.
This wasn't the busiest weekend of the season, but it was in the top five.
Wow.
That's great. You know, it was just busy. And actually, it might have turned out to be the busiest weekend of the year, except for the passes got bad.
Yeah.
And so I had, you know, a couple of my old timers that they've been over that pass when it was bad before. They're not coming over.
Yeah, exactly. Get a little smarter as we get older, don't we? Yeah.
I'm not. I got a four-wheel drive and I got chains, but I don't want to put them on.
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't want to, so I ain't coming. And so we had a couple groups actually cancel out, and they just moved to another weekend. So we'll just pick them up here. But yeah, that's it. The other thing that's really exciting for me is, you know, it's springtime. We're doing our boat rental, starting that boat rental program next month, and I go pick up a new boat this week.
Wow.
So, I mean, how many people get to say they go get a new boat?
Yeah,
so
that's cool.
Might not be as fancy as some of the other people's boats, but it's a boat that people can come and use. And so I'm excited. This has been a long process getting to this point.
A ton.
And I'm excited to go get the new boat and get it here.
Remember when these were ideas on a napkin, and now we're episode five and boats coming in and crazy.
Well, and then on this weekend is the Bighorn Show in Spokane.
Yep.
And so I'll be going, I don't have a booth there, but I'll be going down there. So if anybody, you know, wants to see me or something, give me a text, give me a call, let me know. And I'd be glad to see you. I think I'm going to go down on Thursday. My son shot a really nice buck down in the desert unit this last fall. And I would, as much as I tell everybody I'm not into the score, this one is so unique. Yeah. I have no idea how to judge it as far as a score wise goes. And so I think we're gonna take it with us and get it officially scored just so I can watch and talk to the guys, you know, because my hunters are always interested in, well, what do you think it would score?
Oh, sure. I mean, that's part of it, right? That's part of it.
You know, and not very many times have I seen a deer with three horns. So
yeah,
I don't know what they're gonna do with that third horn.
What's your if somebody wants to text and link up with you in Spokane, what's a number that they could go fast and text with you?
Yeah, the best one would be my cell number. Send me a text or send me an email off the website. But my cell number is 509-681-0218. I carry that with me all the time. As Dave knows from the time you've spent with me, I'm on it all the time. And so please don't think that I'm, you know, blowing you off or not listening or screening my calls. I get spam calls just like everybody else, but I tell you what, I get a lot of phone calls while I'm on the phone with somebody else. Mm-hmm. When I'm on the phone with you, Unless it's an emergency, I'm on the phone with you.
Yeah.
So
treat every customer like they're the only one. Those are some of the greatest hospitality things you'll find at Rusty and Jackie Do. So
you're the most important one at the time.
Yeah.
So
and operators are standing by, so we will take your call.
I don't know about that one, but
how about websites? If people can go, so you know, we've got Pheasant, mule deer programs, Pheasant, all the different adventures with the photography. Yeah. You know, with spring, we got migration patterns, and if people want to come up and stay in the cabins and get some of the most beautiful photography of different animals and stuff. Well, what's your websites that you're running?
Yeah, the one that's getting the most attention right now is the HRO Adventures. We've got people already calling and talking about, it just sounds like you'll do anything. Well, I'll be honest, I won't do anything. I've learned things.
20
not
bucks
to
is
do
20 bucks.
Yeah. So, but I certainly will do my best to customize something to get you out to do what you want
there
to do.
There is so much to do. Just need a little guidance as to how to put it together, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. We've got so many things to do. We got the fishing's going to just get started with the boats. We're going to be shed hunting here. We're going to be taking people out, showing them the wildflowers. Isn't that an interesting one? When do the wildflowers start coming out? Well, you need to be here in late April or early May. We need to get that scheduled out so that I can make sure I'm here.
Yeah, exactly.
The HROAdventures.com is the one that's probably getting people are starting to look at it right now. And then there's the OG, HiddenRanchOutfitters.com. Has been there forever. It's got most of the stuff on. It's got pictures from 20 years of deer and pheasants and different things. I even noticed the other day there was a bobcat, a guy holding a bobcat on there.
Oh, yeah.
Those things of opportunities, you know, when an opportunity presents itself. What a cool thing, you know. I don't think my cougar picture is on there, but I guess everybody can see the cougar from here. Those are the websites to go to take a look at us and see what we're offering. And my phone number and my address is on there, so you guys can give me a call. Let me know what you're thinking, what you're wanting
to
do.
Yeah, you're a great resource, right? Whether you're buying Zeiss scopes or trying to set up an adventure or anything, you're a great resource, have tons of experience, and can probably help somebody make a good decision
where
to spend their money.
Yeah, we just had a group in this last weekend, came in. They did some long range shooting. They shot some clays, had some fun, shot some pheasants. In fact, they only had one dog and there was too many of them. And so I told them, I said, you guys will have way more fun. And that dog will have way more fun if you guys don't kill him off and make him hunt for 2 days, straight. So we brought in a guide for them, and they fit the bill for the guide. And just had a fantastic time. The guide came back to me and said, hey, those guys were great.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome.
And I made friends with them, and they want me to take them out again next year. So we've got some corporate groups coming in, some two bigger groups coming in that are going to be shooting a lot of birds, using a lot of stuff. But this is relationship time. This is time to come in with your group and sit down here and have some food, and you're actually in Rusty's studio when you're staying here.
Exactly.
What a great time to be here. So they can get a hold of me, let me know. Like I said, I will be up at the Sportsman Show on Thursday. So
great. Okay, well, maybe we'll get a little report from that as well. So
that would be fun. Yeah,
all right. Absolutely. Rusty, well, it's time to go work on bows, so you know.
You do got to go tune your bow, don't you?
Not one thing, it's another. So
we need to talk about that here in an upcoming show about getting your bow tuned and those kind of things.
Yeah.
Because the guys, if they're wanting to change bows, now's
the time, right? That's
so
right.
That you can get good
all
with
this
it.
Stuff has a lead time, and so
it does.
We're going to go down to Archery World in Lacey and get tuned up with the Fish Hunt Northwest guys, and should have some stuff to report back to you. And then I think we'll bring the bow. bow next time we come over to the studio and do a little shooting and talking, maybe, or something like
absolutely.
That.
So, absolutely. Right. That'd be fun. Right.
Well, Rusty, be safe out there. Thanks again for the time. And again, if you're looking for a great adventure, we have so many options. Just get a hold of Rusty at the website or on the phone, and he'll build you a custom option that you'll definitely be coming back year after year for. Big groups, bachelor parties, corporate groups, it's all doable. So don't wait any longer. Come take advantage of having a great resource and a great friend in this kind of business. So, Rusty, I appreciate it. And we'll talk to you maybe after we get the bows tuned up tomorrow. How's that sound?
All right. All righty.
Take
Thanks,
it easy,
Dave.
Buddy. Bye.
You bet.